in the 19th chapter of Mishle. Mishle Yutes, we start with a fundamental pasuk, which has its own Yiddish translation, which all of you know better than I do. Rabos machshavos levish, a man has a lot of plans. Batas Hashem yisakum, but Hashem's plan is the one that always ends up happening. Right? What does someone say it? Man plach. Yeah, okay, whatever. Yeah. I've heard it all my life, I still don't know. But yes, Hashem plans. God laughs. I mentioned in the quartering last week that John Lennon song, somebody else listened to the recording and then also sent me the lyrics to the John Lennon song, so thank you everyone. I think Marcia sent it to me last week on the chat too. So yes, life is what happens to you when you're busy making other plans. Mm-hmm. We call that Hashem happens to you when you're busy making other plans. So that's what this pasuk. Rabos Machshavos Vlavish, a classic song. People know the song. Did I sing it last week? Rabos Machshavos Vlavish, Atas Hashem, Yisakum. Yeah? No? Maybe so? I've used it once for a Color War song, if I remember correctly. In Color War, I mean, people know Color War is, right? They have that in Michigan. So in Color War once, I always ended up writing the song, so I didn't like the other stuff. I wrote the songs, and you have to choose a tune that you put the words to that's like your theme. So I think we did Rabos Machshavos, at least for part of a song. I like doing medleys to confuse everybody and make it more more fancy. So I think there was one point we segued into Rabos Machshavos. I don't remember what it was about. I think it was when we were Team Lila. I don't know why I remember that.
Lila.
We were dark. We were just black. Not lilac, just black. Yeah, the other team was day. Something like that. Either way. So here, Avos Machshavos Levish. Where's my notebook? Evan, do you mind getting my notebook from my desk? I do have notes. But thank you. Sorry. Avos Machshavos Levish. So if you look at Rashi, so the question is, when we say Vatas Hashem Yisakum, did I say the joke about the man and woman getting up at night last week? Rabos Machshavos Levish. Yes. Yeah. Okay. I did say it. That the man thinks about getting up in the middle of the night to tend to the baby. Rabos Machshavos. He thinks this. But Vatas Hashem. You know what Hashem wants? Yisakum. She should get up. Thank you. One. Okay. That's not what it means. Says Rashi. Rabos Machshavos Levish, where's Rashi, Chaf Aleph? Wasn't it Rashi? Oh, I must be looking at something else. Okay, let's look, that's why I need my notes. The Mitzudas David. Lefamim, yeah, thank you. Oh, no, it's good. Thank you. Oh, I had this out, yes. Thank you. So if you look at the Mitzudas David, the Mitzudas David explains, Lefamim, Yachshav, Adam, Machshavos, Rabos, Shonos, Zumizil. A person has a lot of thoughts. They're all different thoughts. And not one of them will be mitzkayim. None of them will actually take place. The one that's going to happen is the one that Hashem wants to happen, regardless of if, I think that's what he means, regardless of if it was one of the thoughts you had thought. Meaning you've got a lot of plans. But sometimes Hashem will choose not just one of those plans, but even a different plan that you didn't even think of. So this concept actually is a little bit troubling. Because if you were to say that man plans 10 different things, and Hashem says, okay, this is the one that's going to happen. He chooses one of the 10. Okay, so that's one possibility that at least maintains our autonomy. But if you're going to say that man comes up with 10 different plans, and then Hashem comes up with an 11th, so then we have a problem about Bechira Chafshis, about free will. I chose to do one of these 10 plans. That was my choice. And Hashem's going to change against my choice. So the Malbim has a fascinating, perhaps controversial idea from this pasuk. Says the Malbim. I don't know if it's controversial. I just feel like if anyone ever touches free will, there's going to be a difference of opinion. That's just my take, generally, when it comes to philosophy. Says the Malbim. A person considers all the possibilities, all of the options he could do, he could go through in order to get to a specific result. V'heim rabos. And there are many possible angles and routes that can get you to that place. V'heim b'levish. And those are in the heart of man. We'll talk about that in a second. Ki lo abachir levkor echa mitzadeh hafshar. And because the heart is what makes those choices. Aval b'zeh lo yagia al ha'etza shehi ha'ofen ha'nachon ha'koleh al metaras chavtzo. With that mentality, you will never get to the place that you're trying to get to. V'ha'etzahi, you know what the best wisdom is? May Hashem kefir etzono. The one that's going to win out is from Hashem. B'hitakum, that's when it's going to happen. Then the Malbim implicitly asks the free will question. Wait a second. What about free will? Hashem is choosing against one of the plans that we want. We want to do this. And Hashem says, no, sorry, you're doing that. Isn't that against free will? So obviously we're talking about generalities and there are other ways to answer the question. But, says the Malbim, Shagam Shabachir B'yad Ha'adam, even though choice, decisions are up to man, Gemar Hamasa Itachas Hashgacha. How that plan will actually take place, or how the result of that activity will actually happen, so that success is dependent on whether Hashem wants it to work. You could put in all the effort, and you could make your plans, and you could choose to do one thing, but that doesn't mean it's going to work. Meaning you are really choosing it. You are really going through with that choice. But that doesn't mean you have control over what actually happens. Your choice was given to you, but the result of that choice is not given to you. We don't have control over what actually happens as a result of our activities. Ubeinyanim hakolim shalem, and this is where it gets, this I know for sure is controversial. The first part, I don't know, okay, maybe everyone agrees with that free will means you have the ability to choose. And the result, we'll see if it actually happens. Atas Hashem, he said, come if Hashem wants it to happen, it'll happen. However, there are sometimes, says the Malbim, Ubeinyanim hakolim, and with things that are more inclusive, if you will, that the result of which will have, let's call it a domino effect, hakololim. If somebody does one thing which could often cause, a ripple effect to cause a lot of other things to happen, sha'aleyam tofia asas Hashem, Hashem will bring out what he wants, ha'hashkacha takum utivatel ha'bechira. Wow, that's controversial. Utivatel ha'bechira means Hashem will nullify your choice. You want to choose that? Sorry. Not going to happen. If you choose that, let's say, for instance, Chas v'Shalom, something terrible. Someone wants to, detonate, an atomic bomb. Hashem doesn't want the world to be destroyed. So he will choose against that. Hashem will choose against major decisions. This, by the way, is some of the explanation of what happened with Paro. Some explain, Hashem says, Achrechi dan anochi, Hashem's going to judge Paro. But then wait a second, how can you judge Paro? First of all, Hashem said someone's going to enslave the Jewish people. That's question number one. And then question number two, you don't have to look far into the Parshios of Shmos, Be'er, and Bo to find that Hashem hardened Paro's heart, right? Hashem is constantly controlling what Paro did or didn't do. In which case, is that not taking away his Bechira Chafshis? Is that not taking away Paro's free will? But everyone asks this question. And there are different answers and different approaches. If you look at the Ramban points out, you'll notice very carefully that the first five makas, it never uses that phrase. The first five plagues, it doesn't use the phrase that Hashem hardened his heart. It's the five plagues afterwards and beyond that Hashem hardened his heart, meaning as if to say, the first five he had his free will, and then he lost his chance. You had the choice after 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. After you missed it, so now we're just going to punish you over and over again for that. Right? And that's why Hashem hardened his heart, to punish him for all those things. So that's one way of saying it. Another way of saying it is, Hashem, when it comes to the macro plan of the world, there are certain individuals who are in certain positions of power, or certain episodes that have to happen a certain way. Hashem will dictate that they happen a specific way so that the whole plan still makes sense. Meaning, Hashem is never going to take away anyone's free will holistically, but there are certain episodes at certain time periods, in certain moments where Hashem will take away a person's free will to make sure that the plan of the world still takes place. And that's what says the Malbim, that's what it's talking about here, or that's what the sort of the exception to this pasuk is. Ha'ashkacha takum utavato ha'bechira, divine providence, if you will endure or will be established and will nullify the choice of a person. That is obviously controversial, but nonetheless fits into this pasuk, and reminds me of another idea. This is an idea that I believe I've spoken about in the past, a long time ago. We're talking like 2 years ago. That's how long ago. Brené Brown, I haven't quoted her in a while. Brené Brown, in her book Daring Greatly, has a concept about the anatomy of trust. I believe that's what it's called. She talks about how the anatomy of trust is built up over small activities. Sometimes you think instinctively, and it's really unfounded, but we think instinctively that trust is gained by people who do important things for us. But the big things in our life, those are the people we trust. Not true. The people we trust are the people that remember it's our birthday. They remember that you had an operation coming up. Even though they haven't seen you, they'll reach out. It's the people that remember the little things. Whatever it might be. They remember when you bought those pair of shoes and you're telling them about it, whatever. It's the little things. Those are the people you end up trusting. She goes through this analogy of a marble jar. I don't know if she got it from her kid's teacher or something like that. Every time they do something good, they put one marble in the jar. And it like builds and builds and builds. I don't remember what the whole point is. But she talks about, in the context of that, she talks about what she calls a sliding door. Sliding door moments. She actually says she said it's based on a movie, or she says the same concept is in a movie. I don't remember. But she says there's a movie called something like the sliding door. I actually found it and watched it on 2x speed. I'm sorry, I had my non-Jewish friend watch it, and he told me all about it. I watched it, and it's basically about, it's this interesting movie, I think maybe from the 80s and the 90s, that they play this sequence of events that happens based on whether or not somebody made it out of a subway or made it into the subway, I don't remember, like the sliding doors of a subway. Right, made it into the subway, and then he met one person, and then that led to a whole relationship, and that led to a whole different type of decision process, which led him down a whole path of his life. I don't remember if it was a bad or a good thing. I don't remember. Maybe it was some guy sick or something. I don't remember. And then the movie shifts gears back to the subway station, and I know that movie, but I don't remember what happened in that movie. But this is a different movie than that. It could be a similar thing, but. I think it was called Sliding Doors. I don't know. I might be wrong. But this time he misses the elevator. I don't know if something happens. He misses the subway doors. He never goes onto the train. He goes on to his life in a completely different path. And the point is, the way she was saying it, Brené Brown, in this book, is that we have sliding door moments in our lives. And those moments, you never know what those moments can unfold for us. Right? So I think she brought up an example of, I don't remember. I haven't read this part of the book in like years, but I think she brought up an example of her and her husband. It was either him looking at her or her looking at him, that she could tell when they were getting into bed one night that the husband wasn't either the husband or she wasn't in a good mood. She just had a bad look on her face, like something was wrong. And the other spouse was going into the bathroom. Could have easily ignored the spouse and just walked right into the bathroom, gone, brush their teeth, get into bed while it was dark, and then, go to sleep. But instead, they stopped from going to the bathroom, and then they went over to their spouse and said, "You look like you're having, having something that's going wrong. So you want to tell me about it?" And they had a whole conversation. It was a trust-building moment, but that's a sliding door moment, because you could have easily just lost that opportunity to build that relationship by just going to the bathroom, just sort of, okay, well, deal with that a different time. But instead, took the moment, took that sliding door opportunity and made the most of it, and who knows, built up the relationship in one way or another. So the point is also here, it's not really what the pasuk is talking about, but in the similar sense, there are many thoughts within a person's head about what they're going to do. And Hashem has another plan for you. And instead of doing what you think you're going to be doing, Hashem says, really, this is what you're meant to do. What you're meant to do is to go into this different path. And Hashem is going to sort of navigate you towards that other decision, towards that other path that will lead you to a different road in life, and you'll have no idea why or what happens, but ultimately, you'll live out that sliding door moment that Hashem put you in order so that you can have something down the road. Everyone has their own how you met your spouse story, right? And everyone's got their own story, but You can look back at it and just say, like, if that didn't happen, we would have never got married. If that didn't happen, if so-and-so didn't talk to so-and-so, or if I never went on that trip, or if I never saw the person, or I never ate at this person's house, I would have never met my house, you know, that type of thing. Those are little things, and you never know what went behind all those decisions. Some of that was Asas Hashem. Some of that was definitely Asas Hashem, to put you in that moment, in that time, in that specific situation, in order for you to meet your spouse, or to go over, you know, whatever, maybe it's a business deal or whatever it might be. Rabbos Masha was Lishvatas Hashem Yisakum, as the Mabim is saying here, HaHashkach HaTakum Lishvata HaBechira. Sometimes Atas Hashem is going to undo all of the Rabbos Masha with all of your thoughts. That's the sliding door moment. But I also wanted to focus on, because it's the first Pasuk tonight, and I always somehow just get wrapped up in the first Pasuk, is Belev Ish. What does it mean, Rabbos Masha? If I were to ask you, when we talk about thoughts, where are thoughts held? In your brain,
yeah,
right? Rabos machshavos berosh ish. Rabos machshavos bemoach ish. What's rabos machshavos belev ish? What does that mean, belev ish? Why are they in your heart? So the truth is that maybe we could say that rabos machshavos, where is it that we have many thoughts? That the many thoughts comes from our emotions, comes from our desires. That's obviously pumped through our blood, at least symbolically. That's through our desires, through our heart. Our brains, if we are really using our brains, and when I say brains, I mean system two brains, as Daniel Kahneman would call it, not system one, not the instinctive brain, which is really from the heart, but the system two brain, which is more discerning and deliberating. So that, for the brain, in terms of making decisions, we have much fewer decisions, much fewer options. When we go through our mind and we actually analyze the situation, we'll realize that there are only a couple options. But when is there rabos machshavos? When is there a lot to think about? That's when we're dictated by our desires. You look at your cabinet one day and you say, oh, what do I want to eat? Well, if you ask your mind, if you ask your brain, well, to cut all that half off, right? I can't eat that or the other thing. That's not going to be good at 9 o'clock at night. And I can't eat that thing because it's also not good for a different reason. Oh, I have these two options right here. It's either going to be, you know, whatever, you know, the rice cake or the, you know, I don't know. The celery, I don't know, whatever your choice is. But if you're going with your heart, rabos machshavos levish, so then you have a lot of options, right? You have all the junk food on that side of the fridge. You have all of the sugary cereal on that side of the cabinet. You have anything, whatever you want, you can have, because that's when your heart is desiring, when your heart is chooser, so nothing is stopping you. Your desires are all over the place. And that's levish. That's when you have rabos machshavos, specifically when your heart is deciding. That's when you have a lot of decisions to make, or a lot of thoughts. I read a book last week, you know, organizing the shelves gives you lots of multitasking abilities, right? It's like a menial thing, you're moving books around or whatever. So I listened to like four books last week. And so one of the books was a book called Frontal Fatigue. It came out last year. Can't remember the guy's name. But Frontal Fatigue is a black book with white letters on the front. The book, the tagline is The Impact of Modern Life and Technology on Mental Illness. And it's kind of a scary book, some things that I've spoken about before. It was written last year. I always, whenever there's like any title like that, I always check what date it was published, because if this title, The Impact of Modern Life and Technology on Mental Illness, was written in 2005, it's nowhere near up to date, right? Because that doesn't include Twitter, it doesn't include Facebook, at least in the form that it is now. So this is 2021, probably still relevant. But his point is that our frontal cortex, what's the more technical phrase for the front of the brain? Yeah, I don't know. The front brain, the frontal part of the brain. So he points
frontal
out.
Lobe.
What was that, Joseph?
Frontal lobe.
The frontal lobe. That's just sort of the mechanism of the brain. But the frontal
cerebellum.
No, that's not in the front. I don't know.
Frontal cortex.
It is the frontal cortex. I'm just trying. He was using a different word for it, a different, like, more scientific word. I don't know. Either way. So this, the front part of the brain, is what really is the, I think I talked about this. When did I talk about this? Maybe the Wednesday class. But the frontal part of the brain is responsible for a lot of the mental illnesses. And he talks about how, this is his own thesis, I'm not sure it's backed up by too many studies, although he quotes a bunch of things, but he talks about how the front of the brain is overloaded with so many types of decisions, and it gets exhausted. We've sort of exhausted our mental capabilities to the extent where they're all, you know, they're all, for lack of a more specific term, they're all messed up because of all the types of things that we have to deal with technology and the ways that our emotions are manipulating the way that we look at the world and we make decisions. So he talks about how that has led people to mental illness, the way that they react to things, the way that they deal with things. It has sort of the symbiotic relationship with the way that we take in information. It affects our brain, which then affects how we deal with other situations without having a sort of a healthy balance. Anyways, I just thought about that vis-a-vis this pasuk, rabos machshavos v'lev ish. There are a lot of thoughts that go through your mind, and when you have so many thoughts that go through your mind, and specifically when they're belev ish, when they come from the emotional part of your body, so then that can actually affect how appropriate those thoughts are, or how appropriate that perspective is, until ultimately atas Hashem yisakum, the one that is ultimately going to win over is Hashem's plan. So another possible connection to this very well-known pasuk, which we say every day in Pesukei Zimra. Moving on, I think 20 minutes is enough for one pasuk. Tavas Adam Chasto. There are two ways of understanding this. What is Tavas Adam Chasto? The desire of man is his kindness. The desire of man is his kindness. Who's his? So first and foremost, we could say, Rashi, Iker HaShabrios Mis Adam LaAdam Bavor Chasto. You know the types of people that you like? They're the people that give you stuff. That's right. You like the people that always give you stuff. Every morning we have, almost every morning now. Post-COVID, the Meshulachim, the tzedakah collectors came back. And I'm not saying anything necessarily is wrong with that. Depends on the situation. But, these guys, so I was walking in this morning, and they always ask me this, if they don't know already. Says, is Gary Torgo here yet? I said, I don't know. You have to look in the shul. Like, I'm not in the shul. I'm going to do Daf Yomi. So he says, yeah, he's not there. I said, okay. He says, does he come here? I said, sometimes. I say, didn't he used to go over there? Like, maybe. Like, they just ask me question, where is Gary Torgo? Yeah. So that's Tavas Adam Chasto. The desire of a person is to find the person who's giving them stuff. That's what people are always looking for, the free meal. I don't know, Gary doesn't always come to the morning meal, does he? He's probably on and off, right? A couple times a week or something. Either way. So Tavas Adam Chasto, he has lost Baruch Hashem. He's had Simchas in the last couple of weeks. The week before that, he had an unfortunate thing. But Tavas Adam Chasto means that the desire of people, that's according to Rashi, the desire of people is to find those who are kind to them. Kind to them, giving to them. Chasto typically means to give or with gracious. However, the Ibn Ezra has a different take. The Ibn Ezra says that Tia Lasos Chasto Klomar Yisave Tamid Lasos Chesed L'Misheroi Lo. Says the Ibn Ezra, Tavas Adam Chasto is a instruction. That your desire should be to give. Tavas Adam Chasto. That Yitzaveh Tamid, you shall desire constantly to do good for others. That's Tavas Adam Chasto. That's what you should do. You should always try to give to others. Obviously, the entire premise of Adam Grant's book, Give and Take, is about giving. The entire premise of the Kuntras HaChesed, of Rav Eliyahu Dessler, for those who are familiar with his book, The Miftah of Mi'Eliyahu, which we have on that shelf over there, the one shelf that I'm afraid to touch so far. But he talks all about the importance of giving and the nature of giving. So this is also an interesting thing. I'm not sure if the Ibn Ezra actually believes is saying this, but Tavas Adam Chasto could be not just that one should do this, but one does do this. That a person's true desire deep down is to give to others. And this is interesting given, certain studies, Rav Dessler quotes these studies actually. He says that every person has a natural inclination to give to others, to provide for others. And that's why you find that people that don't have children will oftentimes get a pet. The people that don't have a child around will get a pet. because they have we all have this desire to give. So maybe that's what it's saying here. Tavas adam chasdo, that a person's desire is to give, is to be a gomel chesed, right? We all have a desire to be like Hashem in that way, to do good for others. And therefore, if a person is too busy taking, they will feel unfulfilled because they won't have that, they won't have sort of satiated that desire, that need to really give, to help another person. I remember a friend of my uncle, my uncle passed away in Boca Raton a few years ago, and at the Shloshim, which was live streamed, so I got to listen, so he told the story about my uncle and him when they once saw a poor man come into a shiva house and give tzedakah. Just saw the guy come and give tzedakah. And everybody knew this man because he used to sit on the street and ask for money from people. And my uncle's friend said, that's so fascinating that he's giving, even though he's poor, he's giving of his money to somebody else. It must be because that's he wants to give back. So many people are giving to him, so he wants to give to others. And my uncle told him that's not what it is. For him, that's what the world is. For him, he sits on the street every single day, and people just give him money. That's what he thinks people do. That's, you know, that's his experience of what human interaction is. It's to give to other people. So when he has the ability, he also gives to other people because that's what he thinks people do. Right? It's part of his understanding of the world that people are givers. And that's why he gives, not just because he's giving back, but because people are givers. And that was such an interesting insight, and I'm so glad he said that over on the Shloshim so I could learn that insight from my uncle. Because that's what it's saying here in the Pasuk. Right? Tavas adam chasdo, a person, as long as they have been inculcated with the right values, they've been raised in the right environment, so that will be their desire. They will cultivate that desire to want to give to other people. Unfortunately, if they're brought up in a different kind of culture where everything is about what can I get from this situation and what can I benefit from, so then unfortunately they won't have brought that innate desire to the fore. It'll be sort of couched inside of themselves. Tavas adam chasdo, that's a fascinating pasuk, that whether or not a person's desire is naturally to give, or are they naturally desiring others who give to them. Almost the exact opposite interpretation. V'tov rush me'ish kazav. Better is a rush. Anyone remember what a rush is? Not a rush up, a rush. Like lo eg la rush in a cemetery, you don't wear your tzitzis out for the people that are poor. Those who are deceased are poor for mitzvahs. Rush means poor. So here, tov rush me'ish kazav. Rush is a person who doesn't have what to give. Right, he's poor. So tov rush, better is a poor person than ish kazav. What is an ish kazav? Says Rashi, v'im ish kazav hu umavtiach v'eino oseh. If you're a wealthy person and you say, I'm going to give, I've got this money, etc., but you never actually give, v'eino oseh, you never come through, so then ish rash, tov ish rash mimenu. Better is the poor person. Why is the poor person better? What's better, the person that doesn't have what to give at all, or the person that has what to give and doesn't? The person who doesn't give. Because his expectation is not to give, so he's not getting anyone's hopes up. Right? I believe... Right. A liar, or untrustworthy, whatever. I believe that the Pasuk here is talking about... The Pasuk here is talking not about a general judgment of poor people, but rather the same as the first part of the pasuk, tavas adam. What it is that a person, who is it that a person will cling more to? Tov rush mish kazav. People will cling more to others who are poor but cannot give than people who are rich and don't give. Meaning, like Abraham Lincoln once said, better to remain silent and make people think you're a fool than to talk and prove it or leave no doubt or something like that. Right, the point is, we don't know if the poor person is a good person or not. But the point is, we can't tell either. Right, it could be better. They could be just as bad as the rich guy. But they could be better. And therefore, the rush is better because he at least has the possibility of not being, of being a good person. More than that, however, is the circumstances of the poor person's life, which bring about his character. If you look at the Ralbag has a beautiful concept about this. Says the Ralbag, Hine tavas adam hi b'teva mashu cher palo. That a person is naturally drawn after that which is difficult for him. Ki yetzer lev ha'adam raminu rav, v'yutavosav mipnei zeh el tavas ha'chomer. Because of that, a person is always trying to desire that which he doesn't have. Asher bo nishtatev lebehemos, and in that way we're similar to an animal. Uzeya yoser tov harash lo yasig davar mi'atavos mi'ish kazav, sheyishbatav ve'elu ha'hanaos. That every person, you know, has the desire to want materialistic things. The difference, however, are the people who can or can't do that. Right? Some people don't have the means, and therefore the best thing for them is to not even try. Don't even try to lust after your desires, you're not going to get them. However, the rich person who has the means, who has the resources to chase after those desires, will do so. Says the Ralbag, V'chazav, O yirtze b'zeh tavas ha'adam hi sheyasig chesed Hashem Yisbarach v'dvarim. Oh, see, like, this is a different thing. Hold on. Okay, that's a little bit different. I want to take that first statement from the Ralbag and basically extrapolate it because I think it's a very important concept. The rush, the person who's poor, doesn't necessarily mean he doesn't have desires. But what it means is that despite his desires, he's not chasing after them. As opposed to the chazav, who has the resources and the desires, therefore uses those resources to try to attain those desires. I read a book a week ago, called "Stretch: The Power of Unlocking the Power of Less." I wrote it up in the Shul newsletter for the month of July. For those who want to see it, what it's about, I'll tell you now. Though the concept of stretching is basically to make the most of what you have, and to force yourself to do so instead of chasing after other resources in order to get what you want done. So, for instance, he talks about all these studies about different people's perspective on things, and the different perspective on this concept. And what they did was they would give people sort of very mundane resources and ask them to do some kind of trick or something. So one of them, if I'm not mistaken, I think I've heard this in other books also, about thinking out of the box. I think actually, if I'm not mistaken, Carol Dweck might have talked about this study in her book called Mindset, where they gave a person matches in a candle in a box, and they told them to stick the candle against the wall. That's what they told them. So the people who were less inclined to be, utilitarian, I don't know what the word is, but resourceful, right? They were less inclined to be so resourceful, so they tried all these different things. They couldn't get the candle to stick against the wall. I might be misrepresenting the study. But the people who were resourceful took the box that the candle came in, and they melted some wax from the candle onto the side of the box, stuck the box onto the wall, and then put the candle in the box, and therefore he had the candle, something like that. And the point is that the people that got the box never even entertained the possibility that they could use the box. Whereas the people that were resourceful were like, well, what else do I have at my disposal that I could use? A box is not something you typically use to stick against the wall, but I have it, so why don't I try using it? That kind of thing. So the point is that people who are rush, people who are poor, meaning that they don't have all the resources at their disposal, so they're better than the chazav, the people who have any resources that they ever want at their disposal, and will only use the specific thing that's made for that for a specific purpose. Yeah, I think that he quoted another study in there. The guy's name is Scott Sonnenschein. I think he's probably Jewish. But actually he is, because I told this to somebody else and said, yeah, his daughter just had a bat mitzvah or something like that. Like, the guy looked him up online. It was like, okay, fine. But yeah, so he's definitely Jewish. Not sure what type. But another thing was, they gave somebody like a nail and a wrench to build something with. And the people that were resourceful would take the wrench and use the wrench as a hammer, as opposed to the other people, which said, what am I going to do with a wrench? And they couldn't do anything. right? It's about that sort of the mentality of I have less, but what can I make of what I have less, as opposed to trying to get more. And you extrapolate this to all different types of things in terms of business, in terms of, you know, inventory in your business, in terms of employing the right kinds of people in your business, finding the right kinds of people as opposed to the wrong kind of people. Adam Grant has a wonderful wonderful study that he talks about in the beginning of, I believe it's Originals, where he talks about the difference of customer service. I quoted this in a couple years ago. The difference in customer service between people at a specific company, and they couldn't figure out why this cohort of people were so much better than the other people. And the only thing that correlated was what web browser they used. Remember the study? Fascinating study. The study said, and I don't know, these are only statistics, so no one should feel bad, but the people that used Internet Explorer or Firefox, or Safari, sorry, the people with Internet Explorer or Safari were much worse customer service representatives than the people that used Google Chrome or Firefox. And they try to figure out why, like, what's the difference? And the difference is because your computer comes with Safari and Internet Explorer naturally. You don't have to go find that program. It's already on the computer. As opposed to the people who have Firefox and Google Chrome, they figured out to themselves, how can I make my computer better? They went and they got that program, downloaded it, and used that as their web browser. The people that are willing to sort of go beyond sort of the natural thing that they're given, so those people are more resourceful, and those are the people that are going to be more resourceful in other areas of life too, including the customer service. So that was just like one little vignette that I found so fascinating. I use Google Chrome even before I read the book. But that could just be because I use a Google Chrome book and Google Chrome comes on the computer. No, but I used it even before I had a Google Chrome. So either way, I just find it easier. It just makes everything smoother with my email and everything. But the point is that you have to be resourceful, and that's what it means here. Tov rush miish kazav. That, interestingly enough, you have to go get something else to the Chrome, but it's the same type of thing, which means that sort of like the same kind of thing in terms of the mentality. What else can I use? What else is at my disposal? Pasuk Chav Gimel, 23. Yiras Hashem l'chaim. This is also machlokas. What does this mean? Yiras Hashem leads to chaim, or as the Ibn Ezra says, Yiras Hashem l'chaim ba'avor chaim yarei oso. Ba'avor chaim, because of life, yarei oso. Now, the truth is, you could interpret that in one of two ways also, but at first glance, it seems like the Ibn Ezra is saying, because of your life, you will fear Hashem. Now, I don't know for sure if that's what he's saying. It could be that for the sake of life, you will fear Him. That could be what he's saying. But I'd like to sort of make a drasha based on this Ibn Ezra, the way that he says it, in terms of how I said it before, that that through life, you will fear Hashem, meaning when you fully appreciate life, so then you ultimately understand and appreciate who gave you that life. Yiras Hashem lechayim. V'saveya yalin bal yipaked ra. The Rabbah continues his theme from before and says, the one who is satiated, what is he satiated with? If you have Yiras Hashem, you're satiated with your life. You're satisfied with your life because you understand that Hashem gave you what you need. Hashem gave you for what you need, as they say, if everybody would take all of their stuff, right, all the good stuff and the bad stuff, they put it into a box and put it on the side of the room. And everybody else would take their stuff, their good stuff and their bad stuff, put it on the side of the room, we'd all end up going and taking our own box. Because we'll see what everybody else has and think, that's not for me, because we understand why Hashem gave us our thing. Because it's famous, famous for me, because I've said it a lot, but I don't know if I've said it here. But when I was a kid, I used to say this analogy all the time, is that a teacher asks his class or her class ask them, if they were God, what would they do? They could change one thing in the world, what would they do? And everyone's saying their different thing. They're kids, so some people say Yankees win the World Series, and some people are saying, you know, solve world hunger and world peace and etc. and gas prices, whatever it might be. So, and then one kid in the back never gave an answer. So the teacher says, what would you change if you were God for one day? I have so many things to do. The kid said, I wouldn't change a thing. Wouldn't change a thing. There's so many things wrong with the world, gas prices and the world hunger. And the kid said, if I was God, I would know why everything is the way that it is. And I wouldn't feel the need to change anything. Now, is that a real story? I have no idea.
Yeah.
But the point is true. The point is the same, that we look at the world and we think things are the way that they are, and therefore we have to do something. And yes, we do have to do something to change it. But the way that it is right now, as we say in Kaddish, Bi'alma divarachi rusei, I talked about this last week with Tzumir Chamayr, where a person has a beautiful idea. Bi'alma divarachi rusei, where we say, Yiskada v'yiskada shmei rabba, Bi'alma divarachi rusei. We should make Hashem's name great in the world that He created, Kir Usei, which translated into Hebrew means Kir Tzono. Hashem created it in the world, the world in the way that He wanted it. It says reverse, even right now, with all the problems that you see on the news, that's also Kir Tzono, Kir Usei, that's also the way that Hashem wants it. And in that world, we have to be Yiskada v'yiskada shmei rabba. In that existence, we have to see a way to make Hashem's name great. Yeah. I'm sure. Of course. I can't explain it. Yeah. No, it's easier to say in theory than to say it in practicality, for sure. For sure, yeah. No, I'm not claiming that I can explain any of it, but that's, hard to understand. But the point here is that if you had your Hashem, v'saveya yalin, when you go to sleep, you can feel satiated, you won't be worried. Right, I think about this sometimes in a very much smaller sense, but in terms of the psychology of a child, there's a certain pride I remember taking when we would take our first road trips with Dovi in the car. And obviously, it wasn't that like that conscious of a decision, but he would fall asleep in the car. And now Elka falls asleep, they all fall asleep in the car. And there's a certain pride that you take as a parent in the fact that your child feels comfortable enough that they could fall asleep with you, behind the wheel. It's a big responsibility, obviously, but there's a certain sense of trust that goes beyond just a regular trust with another person. Like, I wouldn't fall asleep in a car with somebody unless, I really trusted them, right? The point being that's what we have here in the pasuk, Saveya Yalin, someone who is satiated, they feel satisfied with Hashem in their life. So then they'll be able to sleep fine. They can go to sleep fine. Va'yipakei ra, they know nothing bad is going to happen to them. If something bad happens to them, obviously it's a different story. But they have at least that trust, instinctively or initially, they'll have that trust in Hashem that they know Hashem is taking care of them, and thereby it's not something they have to worry about when they go to sleep. What do you say, Srita?
No, actually, the child doesn't know any different
anyway. Yeah, right. That's why it's not the same thing. But there's a certain yeah, for sure. But the point is that you have a certain sense of satisfaction and security when you have that Yiras Hashem. Okay, I'll try to do one more pasuk here. Taman atel yado batzalachas. This is a very intriguing pasuk to me. I wasn't able to fully unpack it, but translated according to the article, this is 1924. The lazy one buries his hand in the dish. The lazy one buries his hand in the dish. It's such a descriptive pasuk. The lazy one buries. And what do you think that means? The lazy one buries his hand in the dish. Okay. What does it mean, though? So picture your bubby saying it. Now, what does it mean? What? You don't want to do anything. So why are you putting your hand in the dish? Oh, you're saying it's a resting dish. Okay. Anything else? So I was reading a book yesterday. I was listening to a book yesterday. I forgot what it's called. Something about jokes. I was interested in sort of like the psychology of jokes. It's a very interesting book. But at one point he says that a good joke, part of the conditions of having a good joke is that people understand sort of the context or the elements of the joke. If you say something and they don't understand it, so then it doesn't make any sense. So for instance, you said a joke about a golfer always brings two pants. You know why? He gets to get a hole in one. But if you don't know what a hole in one is, so then you wouldn't get the joke. So he said in his own life, when he grew up, whenever he said, that's a matter of opinion, his grandmother would always say, you don't know this one? Now, Turner, you don't know this one? His grandmother would always say, said the man with a wooden leg. Does anyone get that? That's a matter of opinion, and she would respond, said the man with a wooden leg. Anyone know, Cherner, you get it? No? The word pinion apparently means something wooden. I don't know, it's like a wooden something. The word pinion. I know, it's like an old English word that only the older generations know. But anyways, he remembers his grandmother would always say that, and he never understood what she was talking about. Said the man with a wooden leg. What does that have to do with opinions? So the point is here, what does this phrase mean? That the poor person, That the lazy person. The atzel always has his hand in the dish. So the Mefarshim have different takes on this. One of them is that the person who is lazy is always going to be grabbing other people's food or is grabbing at the cookie jar. Meaning, they're not going to make their own food. They're not going to earn their own wage to buy their own food. They're just going to put their hand back into the dish. They're yado batzalachas all the time. Interestingly enough, the end of the pasuk gives more clarity to it, because the end of the pasuk says, Gam el pihu lo yeshivena. Even to his mouth, he will not bring it. What does it say? He will not even return it to his mouth. Now, there's two ways you can understand that. Either he's so lazy, he won't even take what's in the dish and bring it to his mouth, or he's been so lazy that he's depleted his entire resources, all of his food, and there's nothing even in the jar anymore. There's nothing in the dish. Because he's so lazy, he won't even go out and get more food. He won't even go out and get his money so that he can buy more food. He'll just sit there with his hand in the jar and saying, okay, woe is me. Just sit there with his hand in the jar. That kind of thing. And it's obviously sort of like a harsh reality, sort of a laziness to the extreme. But obviously, we could sort of connect it to other, analogies in the modern world. You know, you give your give the older child still sleeping in their parents' basement analogy, that kind of thing. It might not literally be a dish, and it might not literally be his hand in the dish, which is empty, but he's got nothing going on in his life, and he's not doing anything about it, that kind of thing, right? So there is certainly sort of the analogy still rings true, even if it sounds kind of harsh, in the wording of Shlomo HaMelech. But let's see if I can get one commentary here on here. So the Rabbeinu Yonah says, "Derech haSefer hazeh, kasher yazkir inyan hayira, yidaber al haTzala." Not always the case, but the Rabbeinu Yonah says, oftentimes in Mishle, whenever it brings up yira, a person who is fearful of Hashem, it'll bring up laziness. Then kasher yazkir inyan haChachma, it talks about wisdom, levisha yira, haChachma tzrichas drizus gevura. That yira and Chachma require a certain alacrity. When a lazy person does an activity, they will never stop. I want to say that's what he means. They'll never stop. And you can understand the flip side of that is someone who is fearful. Someone who's doing a mitzvah and doesn't finish it, they'll be called lazy. It's an interesting Mishnah. We did it recently in the 7 o'clock chakras, post chakras, and Mishnah himself says that the Karban Pesach was brought with three different groups. And the Beis HaMikdash on Erev Pesach, they would have these huge groups come into the Beis HaMikdash. They would all shecht their Karban Pesach together. After the Beis HaMikdash, after the Azara, the courtyard is full, they would close the doors and say, okay, Ad Kan, group number one. Then they let them all out, they clear out the blood or whatever, then group two comes in, and then until it's full, and then they close the doors, and then they let them out, and all the blood out, whatever, and then group three comes in, right? So the Gemara says that the third group had a nickname. You know what the third group's nickname was? The Kas Atzlanim, the lazy group, because they were the last ones. Says the Gemara, what do you mean the last ones? You just told us that there have to be three groups. If there have to be three groups, so then someone's got to be the third group. So why are you calling them lazy? You just said someone has to. Well, that doesn't make them not lazy just because they're not, just because they're part of, part of the process. So you have to be, zaris to go do the mitzvah. You have to be part of the first two groups. Yes, there's always going to be a third group. The Gemara says it's analogous to something else I won't talk about, but it's analogous to a spice merchant. Spice merchant? I don't remember. I think it was a spice merchant. who sells like really rancid spices. People buy them, and somebody's got to sell them, but he still smells, right? The guy still smells. It doesn't matter. The fact that people are buying them doesn't make it any less smelly, right? So it's true, there might be a good reason for it, but it's still the nature of that person is still lazy. So says Rabbeinu Yonah, ha'os the mitzvah v'lo yashlam malach le'yikra atel, someone who's doing a mitzvah, but he doesn't do it fully. So they're called lazy. Someone who starts a mitzvah, just tell him to finish it. Someone starts lighting Hanukkah candles, got to finish it. This, by the way, is halachic ramifications to it. The Ramah tells us, I think it might be about focus, but the Ramah says that on Friday afternoon, Shabbos Hanukkah, right, going into Hanukkah, so typically you have to light the Hanukkah candles after Mincha. That's sort of like a minhag to do so. And some people actually have a Mincha early, we don't do it, but there's like, what if they started lighting the Hanukkah candles and the Chazan has to daven Mincha before Shkia, before the sunset? So, right, you mistimed it so that you have to do lighting first, because by the time you finish Mincha, it's already going to be Shabbos and then you can't light candles anymore. So one of the options that's brought up is, well, maybe the Chazan could say the bracha, light the first candle and then start Shmoneh Esrei right away, right, in order to sort of make it quicker to get to Mincha before Shabbos starts. So the Ramah says, or somebody says, maybe that's what the Ramah says, and somebody else comes to disagree. So no, mitzvah, omer lo gemor, he's got to finish the mitzvah. Doesn't matter that Shabbos is coming, you have to, if you start a mitzvah, you got to finish it. That kind of thing. So here also, what it means is in terms of mitzvot, not just in terms of actual physical laziness, but even in terms of mitzvot, that the taman atzal yada batzalachas, the lazy person is, his hand is in the jar. What does that mean, his hand is in the jar? We're going to extrapolate from the Rabbeinu Yonah. What it means is he put his hand in the jar. How does his hand get there? He started the process of getting food. Right? He put his hand in there, but then he never took it out. Right? Sort of like an even more, harsh analogy. You started something, but gam el pihu lo yeshivena. He's never going to actually put the food to his mouth. He's never going to eat the food. That's how lazy he is. It sounds crazy, but how many of us, we get up in the morning, the men here at least, we get up in the morning, we bring our tefillin with us, we go to shul, we drive all the way, we get to our spot, we undo our tefillin, we put our tefillin on, we put it all on, it's all put in the right place, and then all of a sudden we just don't pay attention during davening. Right? You went through all that effort, you came to shul, you got up early in the morning, you put your tefillin on, you did the whole thing, and then you left your hand in the cookie jar. Right? Because you started the mitzvah, and then you stopped in the middle and just said, oh, okay, now I'm lazy. Now I'm just going to stop. I put enough effort in. Also has to do with that book, Frontal Fatigue, not for now. The point is that sometimes we get lazy in the middle of a process. If you're going to do a mitzvah, do it right and finish it. My father used to say if you're going to do something, you might as well do it right, something like that. You know, if you're going to do it anyway, right? You're going to do it anyway, you might as well do it the right way, right? So as opposed to doing it the wrong way and then having to do it again. Right? So just do it the right way. Either way, so this is that last topic. Laziness, not just of physical laziness or of financial laziness, but of religious laziness. If you start a mitzvah, make sure to finish it. That's how the Rabbeinu Yonah explains it, but I'm sure there are other explanations that talk about that actual literal laziness in terms of what we have to do in our obligations in life. Okay, lots of stuff we covered today. All the thoughts that we have, they come from the heart. But if we do so discerningly with our minds, so much better. People love givers, or you should naturally, we love to give. You just have to find that desire. And the poor person is better because he has to stretch his resources as opposed to the person who has resources. Those are going to be chasing more. We saw the Yiras Hashem is life, and you'll go to sleep satisfied when you have the proper perspective that Hashem is taking care of you. Okay. I wish you have a good night. Shkaya.
Thank you,
Trina, Steve, Marsha, Joseph, and Hannah. Good to have you. Have a good night.